Kings to Rome doing bluegrass, Undisclosed Sims doing psychedelic jazz, Roscoe Foster and the Rascal Theory doing blues, and then some Celtic punk by Boiled and Lead with a special appearance by the Forward Marching Band. So looking forward to that a few weeks from now here in Madison. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin, listener-sponsored community radio. Stay tuned for a public affair right after the BBC, and after that, it'll be the Madison Bookbeat and all-around jazz. So hope you are having a good beginning to your week. This is Martina Varado. Thanks to Rob McClure for the weather report, for Dan Talmo for the set of music, and also to David Simmons and Maggie Schenk for the interview on Mother Courage Alone that Fermat's Last Theater is putting on this weekend at the Arts and Literature Lab.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Iranian state media say several diplomats have been killed in a suspected Israeli strike on an Iranian consulate building in Syria's capital Damascus. A senior commander in the powerful Iranian Revolutionary Guards, Mohammad Reza Zahedi, is reportedly among the dead. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports.
Videos posted online show a big explosion in the upmarket district of Mezeh in Damascus. Iranian and Syrian state media say the Iranian consulate was hit and blame Israel for the attack. There's been no comment so far from Israel, which is known to have carried out many attacks on Iranian-linked targets in Syria in recent years, but has very rarely acknowledged them. Such attacks have increased since war erupted between Israel and Hamas, which is backed by Iran. But this appears to be a new escalation, which seems bound to prompt a response from Iran, most likely through its proxy forces in the region.
Palestinian medics say they are retrieving dozens of bodies from the ruins of Gaza's biggest hospital, Al-Shifa, after Israeli forces pulled out at the end of an intense two-week operation. The Israeli military says it killed and detained hundreds of gunmen and seized weapons and intelligence documents. It says the raid was conducted while preventing harm to civilians, patients and medical staff. The Gaza Health Ministry says the hospital is now completely out of service. A court in Russia has extended the pre-trial detention of a Russian-American journalist by another 2 months. Also Komarsheva worked for Radio Free Europe in Prague. Steve Rosenberg has more detail.
Alsu Kormasheva holds both American and Russian citizenships. Last year, on a trip to Russia to visit her ailing mother, the authorities confiscated her passports. She was fined for not reporting her American citizenship and then, a few months later, arrested. She was charged with failing to self-register as a foreign agent. Alsu Kormasheva's employer, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, has accused the Russian authorities of conducting a deplorable criminal campaign against her simply because she is an American journalist.
Bosnia and Herzegovina's first ever trial has begun of a person accused of glorifying war crimes. Vojin Pavlovic faces charges including inciting racial and religious hatred, Guy Delaunay reports.
Prosecutors say he caused anxiety and fear by producing posters last year wishing the former Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic happy birthday and good health. He pasted the posters around Bratunac, an ethnically mixed town close to the site of the Srebrenica massacre. Mladic is serving a life sentence for genocide for his role in the deaths of 8,000 Bosniak Muslim men and boys. It's the first prosecution to be brought under a law criminalising genocide denial. Victims' associations have welcomed the trial, but they also want prosecutors to use the law against nationalist politicians who glorify war criminals.
BBC News. Police in the Czech Republic have launched a criminal investigation after surgery commonly used for abortion was mistakenly performed on a pregnant woman. The patient mix-up happened in a hospital in Prague. The woman, who was meant to have a routine checkup, miscarried her baby after the operation. The minimum wage for fast food workers in the US state of California has risen to $20 an hour as a new law comes into force. The average increase of 25% affects about 500,000 employees at some of the biggest restaurant chains, including McDonald's, Pizza Hut, KFC, Subway and Starbucks. Michelle Fleury has more detail.
This law dates back about a year, and it was unusually involved negotiations between unions and some of the franchise owners that typically kind of make up many of the fast food restaurant chains you see. We've heard from some franchise owners saying this really is going to raise their costs at a time they can't afford it. On the flip side, part of the reason you're seeing this increase in wages is a recognition. You know, historically, these were jobs associated with teenagers, summer jobs, seasonal work. Now there's a recognition these jobs are often filled by women, they're often filled by immigrant workers, and so this is trying to help them make more of a living wage.
There's been widespread anger in Ghana after a 63-year-old traditional priest married a girl of 12. The customary wedding ceremony took place outside the capital Accra on Saturday. The legal age for marriage in Ghana is 18, and the prevalence of child brides has declined, but the practice continues. The sports equipment company Adidas has banned fans from buying German football shirts customised with the number 44 after complaints were made that it resembled the symbol used by Nazi SS units. The SS was responsible for the most severe crimes carried out by the Nazis in the Second World War. Adidas, which is a German company, said the resemblance to the SS symbol was not intentional. And that's the latest BBC News.
Hi, I'm Mel from The Mel and Floyd Show. Come on down and join Floyd and me Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival live show. This year we'll be broadcasting from the Bartell Theater, 116 East Mifflin Street. We'll be interviewing our usual assortment of interesting people from the fest, including directors, actors, writers, people from the craft services table, and if we have some time to fill, maybe some interesting-looking passersby. We'll cover raging film controversies such as popcorn, butter or no butter, seating, center or aisle, and how to properly shush a loud patron. Heady stuff? It certainly is. Yes, it's going to be quite the wild ride indeed. So let's all go to the lobby. Come join the fun with Mel and Floyd at the Bartell Theater Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival remote broadcast.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribe.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Sarah Gabler, filling in for Douglas Haynes. On today's show, we're talking about flooding, like the catastrophic floods of August 2018 that devastated communities in southern Wisconsin. I'm joined by three guests who will share their expertise on flood mitigation efforts and how to educate and empower communities to protect their watersheds. Tim Palmer is a photographer, writer, and former land use planner. He is the author of more than 30 books, and we'll be discussing his latest book, published this month by the University of California Press, called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. Among many honors for his work and books, he has received a Conservation Achievement Award from the National Wildlife Federation, the Ansel Adams Award for Photography from the Sierra Club, and the Lifetime Achievement Award from American Rivers and the National Outdoor Book Award. We're also joined by two representatives of the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council, a nonprofit based in southern Wisconsin. Nancy Wedwick is an educator, lawyer, organizer, grandparent, fifth-generation Coon Valley resident, and president of the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council. That's a nonprofit she and her neighbors formed in response to increasingly severe flooding in their region. While generating flood resilience may be one of the council's immediate goals, Nancy ultimately sees her work as part of a movement to build collaborations within and across watersheds and to imagine a safer and more sustainable future for her community. She is passionate about enhancing watershed literacy by nurturing the relationships linking people to each other and to the lands and waters they share. And we also have Cindy Waddell, the current watershed coordinator for the council. She began collaborating with the council as a master's student. I'm sorry, did I get that wrong, Sydney? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's keep going. Sydney, if you'll please introduce yourself in a moment. I apologize for that. I do thank you all for joining me today and for the conversation that we're going to have. I want to start with the personal. Each of you is motivated by your personal experience of a flooding event. I'd like to hear from each of you about how you were energized to become an educator and advocate. Okay, folks, we're having a minor soundboard issue. Hang tight.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street morning, afternoon edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported.
Okay, and we're back. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Community Radio, where it takes a community to get this radio moving. This is a public affair, and we're talking about floods and watersheds today. My guests are Tim Palmer, author and photographer, Nancy Wedwick, and Cindy Waddell from the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council. I'm not sure where the audio cut out for you all, but we're just going to jump back in. And I want to hear from these three folks who have joined us today about their experiences of floods and flooding events that really energized or motivated your activism for your communities. Tim, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Nancy and then Sydney.
Okay, so many years ago, during the Hurricane Agnes flood of, get this, 1972, I happened to live at ground zero of the storm. And the place I was in almost got flooded, but not quite. I ended up helping neighbors in emergency restoration and recovery. And as soon as I could get out, I went back to my job, which was as the environmental planner for Lycoming County, Pennsylvania. And in that job, my duties were not only to consider how we needed to recover, but more importantly, how we could avoid catastrophes like this in the future. And that was the motivating force, you know, the genesis of my concern for floods, which has now gone on for 50 years, culminating in the book that I've just written called Seek Higher Ground.
Nancy?
Hi. So my experience with flooding, living here in the Coon Creek watershed, western Wisconsin, near La Crosse, we have experienced floods over the years at different times. And one of the earliest that I can remember was being in high school when our park in our little village got flooded. In the last 10 years, the flooding has increased in intensity and in frequency. And in 2018, in one night in our watershed, we had a ridiculous amount of rain and we lost three of our PL-566 dams. They failed, breached, overtopped. And that caused a wall of water to flood this entire area. And a few things struck me. The first thing was how wonderful people can be when they show up with shovels and they don't know you and you don't know them and they say, how can I help? That brought me to tears. Second, we were so incredibly fortunate because there was no loss of life. Thirdly, as time wore on, we began to ask ourselves, what can we do to help ourselves in these situations? And out of that, the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council was born.
Yeah, and Cindy, how did you get involved with the group?
Thanks, Sarah. Well, I grew up in the Lake Michigan watershed near Milwaukee, and I remember being a kid in 2008 and 2007 when we had some pretty serious flooding there. But it was really in Madison where I did my undergrad in 2018, the same flood Nancy's describing, that same week there was a series of pretty bad floods across southeast Wisconsin, or southwest Wisconsin, and maybe people listening in the Madison region will remember that as well. It certainly made an impression on me, thinking it was all, you know, very serious and concerning, but I had knew how bad it was just a few watersheds to the west. Nancy is based in Coon Valley, until a year later when, as an undergrad at UW-Madison, I participated as a student in an oral history project where we interviewed people who had experienced flooding in the region as part of an effort to guide recovery efforts in the future there and prevent flooding or reduce flooding in the future and think about interventions and in that sense. And that's how I connected with the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council eventually.
Yeah, thanks, y'all. I also have a connection to flooding from my childhood and adult life. I'm from Houston, Texas, born and raised there, and as an area hit by hurricanes and heavy rainfall, lots of flooding. It's a city, a bunch of concrete built on top of a wetland, so prone from the perspective of human development to flood. I want to reach out to listeners. If you have a story that you want to share, if you want to ask our guests on the show a question, you can give us a call. The number to WORT is 608-256-2001. You're listening to A Public Affair. Our guests today are Tim Palmer and Nancy Wedwick and Cindy Waddell. Thank you all for joining us and for being patient as WORT transitions to a new soundboard today. So we're getting all the kinks worked out, and we're grateful for our guests for their patience. We're going to get to the issue of recovery and resilience in the show today. But before we get there, let's take a step backward, because Tim, in your book, Seek Higher Ground, you historicize how we get to this point with flood control and flood management efforts. And when I was reading, it struck me that one of the key events in this history is the Federal Flood Control Act of 1936, which established that it was the, quote, proper activity of the federal government, unquote, to manage and mitigate a flooding on rivers in the U.S. And can you talk about how this legislation kicked off a flurry of dam constructions across the country?
Sure. Before that, of course, there were floods. There have always been floods. But there was not a national commitment to deal with them. They were considered kind of local events. And then gradually, the federal government became involved in supporting levees to protect people from floods. And even the Army Corps of Engineers was behind the levee movement entirely, to the extent of opposing dam construction to control floods. But in 1936, the floods were so big that it galvanized national support to up that game of flood control with a massive program of dam construction. We proceeded to spend billions of dollars. The Army Corps of Engineers built 400 major flood control dams across the United States. So, in spite of spending those billions of dollars to try to stop floods from occurring, which never happened, we spent billions of dollars building levees trying to keep floods away from our homes and businesses, even though that didn't happen. Billions more on relief, helping people after floods occurred. All the time, the damages from floods continue to grow worse and worse and worse. Until now, we have the issue of global warming causing our floods to be even more extreme. So, to me, the age of denial is over. We have to recognize that we need to take responsibility. We have to prevent new development on open space floodplains where they still exist. And we have to help people relocate to be done with the problem wherever people are willing to go.
Yeah, Nancy and Sydney, the Coon Creek watershed, the dams built on in that watershed, those were constructed in the 1960s. Is that correct? Part of this wave of dam construction that Tim kind of laid out for us.
Yes, that's correct. early 60s, late 1950s, early 60s. And of course, what we're facing now is the dams are aging out. They have reached or exceeded their lifespans. And so we are in the midst of ending stage, beginning stage of the decommissioning of all of the dams in the Coon Creek watershed. So we have 14 here in the Coon Creek watershed and 23 in Vernon County, which is a quarter of the dams that were built at that time in the state of Wisconsin. So we have that compounding the issue of flooding and climate change that we are dealing with here.
Yeah, let's dig into that issue, because one thing that I learned, Tim, from your book is that levees and dams can be very effective at preventing small and medium-sized floods. But the August 2018 flood was unprecedented in the amount of rainfall, and that caused the dams to fail, but also their age, Nancy, as you mentioned. So I want to hear from you all talking about what happens over time to these constructions. Tim, from your perspective, and then Nancy and Sydney, maybe we could dive in a few minutes to the issue of the dam decommissioning process.
Right. So dam failures are the worst type of flood of all. There are many types of floods, but if you picture the most typical being that it rains for 2 days, the water gradually rises, people get out of the way, you have this bell curve of flood levels, it crests and it subsides. That's the result of one storm typically. But in the case of a dam failure, we're talking about a situation where a dam has held water back, has held the storms back, sometimes for multiple years in the cases of big dams. And so instead of having the results of one storm flooding our communities, we have the results of dozens and even hundreds of storms all coming at once when that dam breaks. And you have dramatic examples that you're working on there in Wisconsin. There are enormous cases where this is a hazard. I mean, look no further than Oroville Dam in California in 2012, the tallest dam in the United States, almost failed, and it would have flooded millions of people. So maintaining these dams and fixing the problems we have is of utmost importance. In many, many cases, that's not worth doing because the dams are small, the problems are severe. We should just get rid of those dams and be done with the hazard.
Nancy, Sydney, your perspective?
Sure. The Coon Creek watershed has 14 of these dams. In Vernon County, like Nancy said, has 22, which is a very high concentration. But if listeners are in Madison right now, there are 3 of these dams in Iowa County and 11 in Sauk County, just adjacent to Madison in Dane County. And those dams are on a similar timeline. And across the nation, there are more than 12,000 of these dams that are all hitting their expiration dates. One condition that made the situation in the Coon Creek watershed so unique was the dams are anchored into this highly fractured sandstone bedrock, which, you think of bedrock being something that, but over the course of the dam's 50-year lifespan, this can fracture and this erodes and shifts, and the dams aren't actually anchored to something that's all that stable. And kind of in a different sense of things being stable that the dams are anchored to, the political economic condition that supported the dam's original construction, all of those changed as well. So now we're somewhere 50 years in the future, and the conditions that the dams are supposed to be protecting and the physical material to which they're anchored, it's all different now. And it's a really uncertain moment, but I think we know what we need to do, which is think beyond the dams and think expansively about other ways to meaningfully live well with floods in our watershed and in watersheds across the nation.
So that is what actually we are working on, because we understand that the dams have aged out and are not the answer for us. However, what we are looking at are what are the other things that we can do ourselves to help with this situation. One of the most hopeful things that ever happened to me was when I learned that there actually are things that you can do to infiltrate water and to mitigate flooding, especially in this geography that in which we live and in others too. And that has been our message, our work, and our hope as part of the Clinton Creek Community Watershed Council, which is to start to educate, make people aware, and establish those land management practices that do help in these situations.
Yeah, and before we get to some of those efforts, which I think our listeners are going to be very interested in hearing about, I wanted to talk to Nancy and Sydney about the federal dam decommission process a little bit more, about what's happening in your community. This connects some to Tim, your book. You write about the Army Corps of Engineers having a national inventory of dams in which 2,300 of these dams are marked as high hazard, so that they have a high likelihood of failure that would endanger life and property. So what we're seeing in Wisconsin is part of this national network of these dams aging. And as Sydney mentioned, I thought that was really interesting that 50 years later, not only are the material conditions of these dams altered, but the political will to maintain them has changed. And we're living with those consequences. So one of those consequences being that some of these dams are scheduled for decommission. Nancy, what does that mean?
Well, currently we're in the final stages of the plan PEIS. So after 2018, when three of our dams breached and two in the West Fork Kickapoo watershed, NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, said, we've got to take a look at this situation. Five dams, one night, PL 566 dams, what's going on here? And so they commissioned a study that took a number of years. And finally, at the end of 2023, they came out with their draft plan. Initially, the study, the purpose of it was to look at how to prevent flood damage, how to reduce damage from flooding. And over time, that purpose became, how do we reduce flood damage from breach of dams? And so the recommendation that came out of that study was to decommission all of the dams in our watershed. And what decommissioning means, it does not mean removing the dams. It means, in this case, cutting a V-notch into the dams down to a 100-year storm level, and then leaving the rest of the structure in place, sloping it back. And so for us, what that means is the water, when it comes, will initially come more quickly and it will come faster, but then recede more quickly. This is what our understanding is, what we're being told. And there will be areas that will be flooded much more than they were before, although they tell us that that impact is not going to be widespread. So that is what we are facing here. And what we, of course, are interested in doing is, as these dams are being decommissioned, at the same time, what are other things that can be done to help make that running water walk, slow that water?
Yeah, what does that mean to make the running water walk?
So the Coon Creek watershed, when we first formed as a council, looked to our roots, looked to our history. And this is the site of the nation's first large-scale conservation demonstration. So in the 1930s, years of the Dust Bowl, people were looking at, my goodness, what can we do? And so Hugh Hammond Bennett from the Soil Erosion Service, Aldo Leopold, UW-Madison, local entrepreneurial farmers, all of these people came together, and Aldo Leopold wrote an application to the Soil Erosion Service, and this area was selected as a place for large-scale watershed demonstration. So what the effect of that was is the Theodore Roosevelt sent the Civilian Conservation Corps here, And together with members of my family in the past and many other people in this area, they went to work terracing the earth. So building these terraces that would slow the water as after it rains, installing contour strips, contour strip farming, rotational farming, small dams, small retention ponds. There are, in fact, we recently have put a tour together where you can go and see one of the dams constructed in 1936 by the Civilian Conservation Corps. Still in use today, and it's kind of fun to look at because all the cement, there's no cracks in it. And so these are the various things that can be done, the practices that were installed at the time. So we look at that. We look at, you know, the new technology. What's the new ag technology? Cover crops, silvopasture, managed grazing, all sorts of things out there that you can do as land management practices so that when the rain comes, it sinks into the earth rather than running down the hill. So you make it walk so that it slows down. Will those things work in, you know, one of these huge rainstorms we get? To a degree, but not completely. However, the effect of this is to reduce the flooding and prevent some of the damages.
You're listening to A Public Affair on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. Our guests today are author and photographer Tim Palmer, along with Coon Creek Community Watershed Council advocates Nancy Wedwick and Sydney Waddell. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. The direct line here is 608-467-0288. I'll say that one more time, 608-467-0288. I notice a trend between Tim, your book, and Nancy and Sydney, what you've been saying here, and that's that floods are with us. They're going to continue happening. And Tim, as you say, they serve an important function to ecological life. Can you say more about that, Tim?
Sure. There's a whole different side to this flood damage coin. You know, it's not all mayhem and destruction, even though that's what the news media and human suffering tends to focus on. But floods have been with us forever, of course. They're part of the hydrologic cycle. We all know it. The water evaporates over the ocean. It rains over land, runs off through rivers to the sea again. And sometimes it runs off in very large amounts. This has always happened. And the greater natural community has evolved with this to not only be able to accommodate floods, but it actually needs floods to function as it was originally doing. For example, a lot of fish species need floodwaters to effectively shape the river channel in the most healthy ways. Floods are what hydrologists call the source of the pool and riffle sequence. Floods actually form the riffles and carve out the pools, both of which are essential for river health, because we need riffles for oxygenation, we need pools for deep cold water. Plus, floods overflow onto their floodplain and create the best nurturing habitat and rearing habitat for many fish species. So if you like fish, you have to like floods. Floods are what wash sand and silt out to sea, which forms our ocean beaches. So if you like beaches or beachfront development along our coasts, in a way you have to like floods because that's what brings the beach sand there. Floods are what cover the floodplain, with water that then soaks into the ground to form our groundwater supplies. Half of our population lives off of groundwater. So if you want to drink water coming out of the tap, in many places you have to like floods. So in short, floods are essential to many of the ways that nature works. And by recognizing that and trying to live with nature rather than trying to totally control it, by stopping the floods from occurring or by simply blocking them off with levees, we'll be much better off in the long run.
Nancy and Sydney, do you enjoy some of the effects of the riverways, from flooding in the Riverway City?
Tim, thank you for raising that point. It's reminding me of a 2005 study out of UW-Madison that looked at, you know, the flood control dams in the Coon Creek watershed, these PL-566 flood control dams. And it found that, this is using models, but it, and under a modeled scenario, it found that, you know, nutrient cycling is really impeded when you have flood control dams, specifically like in the environment that Nancy and I are working in right now. And another issue that we are so concerned about, as you know, our watershed council, we're very concerned about flooding, but you know, we're not all flooding. We care a lot about clean drinking water and stream habitat and everything that makes our watershed community thrive. And these flood control dams seriously impede nutrient cycling in the floodplains where these important processes happen. And you know, that has a direct impact, like those nutrients that aren't taken up and converted in floodplains end up in our streams and impair water quality. And then that moves downstream and you have, you know, the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia zone and all these things are connected. And, you know, catastrophic flooding is harmful, but we do need the very same small floods. You know, the dams aren't supposed to prevent large floods either. The dams are supposed to be preventing those, you know, 2 year to 25 year nuisance floods. That's what they were built for. And those are exactly the type of floods that really drive a lot of critical stream processes.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of work to take in the bigger picture of a full ecosystem and what one effect might have on it, like constructing a dam or a levee. I want to ask you guys more generally speaking, from your experience, what role should the government play in managing, mitigating, and responding to the crises that emerge from these dams? Nancy, we can start with you and then go to Tim.
So I think the picture is much bigger than the crises that emerge from the dams. You know, we managed to arrive here as settlers, you know, some 150, 200 years ago in that range, and brought with us our practices that worked very well in Northern Europe, Western Europe, did not work so well here. And so some of the things that we did created a lot of the problems that we had. And then we came together, worked as a community with the government and with the university, and were able to correct a lot of that. Then people did what they thought at the time was to build these dams and put these dams in. And now, you know, we are learning and we know they're aging out and not the best solution. So now it's time to look for other ways that we can continue to live here sustainably, learn to live with the flooding, the good effects of the flooding. And I think that in order for that change to take place, we do need the help of the government in our situation. So we are looking to NRCS, to USDA, to the federal government to actually help us create a pilot project here so that we can do a number of things to make just living more sustainable when we are faced with climate change and all the things that we must recognize and start to do in order to leave less of a footprint.
And Tim, I wonder if you could get some perspective on the role that insurance plays here. You write about, and this is one of the most interesting things that I learned from your book, is that the insurance industry and real estate development really shaped flood control projects. Could you speak to how that happened and what the effects were?
Yeah. Let me just for a minute backtrack here to your earlier question of what should the government actually be doing. I mentioned before we spent billions on dams and levees and relief, but very little on the fundamental problem of avoiding flood damage. It turns out 90% of our floodplains are largely open space. They're not heavily developed yet. So if we don't protect that open space land from development, the flooding problem could get 90% less. So that's very important. And it's very important that we not only help flood victims after the floods occur, but help stop the problem from happening again. Two really interesting numbers to me here were developed by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Tracking thousands of data points, they found that for every $1.70 the federal government spends helping people move away from the flood hazard and be done with the problem, we spend $100 helping them stay where they are to get flooded again through flood relief, through subsidized insurance, which was your second question here, and other measures. So one of those is federally subsidized flood insurance. Floods are not, if anybody at risk needs to buy insurance, and we all buy fire insurance. Floods are kind of the same way, except floods are far more widespread and damaging than fires. So the insurance industry knows all this. They're very well informed. They know that flood insurance would be very expensive to actually pay for itself. So that's an untenable operation in their worldview of economics. So federally subsidized insurance was required if normal people living in flood damage areas are going to be covered. We adopted a national program in the 50s and 60s. We bolstered it up in 1973 after the Hurricane Agnes flood to require federal flood insurance for federally backed mortgages, which almost all mortgages are. This was part of a two-pronged approach. One was to offer the subsidized insurance to those people who are unfortunately already on the floodplain and couldn't afford insurance, provided, however, that the community zones the floodplain to see that the problems won't continue to get worse. And it was a brilliant formula that everybody at the time, including myself and a lot of other land use planners, were very eager to see pursued. Unfortunately, it didn't work out the way it was planned. And in fact, because of the incentives provided by federally backed insurance, which the taxpayers support, we've actually ended up encouraging more development on the floodplain because now the taxpayers assume part of the burden of loss. So the federal flood insurance program is a great idea. It has not worked out very well, but there are very practical reforms that could be taken to fix many of those problems. That's another subject I'll let go for now.
Thanks, Tim. And we do have a caller on the line. We have David Fowler, who has a question about the perception of flooding risk. David, thank you for calling. Welcome to A Public Affair.
Well, thank you very much. Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you, Dave.
This is a quick question for all the panelists. I worked as the floodplain administrator or floodplain manager, project manager in Milwaukee for many years. One of the things that I'm concerned about is that the public perception of flooding is so is just not there. And in many cases, the risk that they face is unmapped or the maps are so old that they don't understand that map. And that's true here in Wisconsin and pretty much throughout the country. I don't know if you could speak to that about like the Coon River. I don't know how old the maps are there, but I'm assuming they're pretty out of date. So that the risks that we're calculating may be way misunderstood and that people are at risk and they have no clue that they are at risk. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Nancy, and then Tim, maybe Sydney too.
Sure. Yeah, the mapping is one of the questions, and that is something that is hopefully coming soon out of this study, because we do know that to some degree those maps are out of date. As to the perception, that's actually a pretty fascinating question. I could probably talk way too long about the perception of flooding risk. First of all, depends upon whether or not you're even familiar that these dams are in existence, because these are for the most part dry dams. And so they hold water in time, they slow water in times of a flood or a huge storm event, but otherwise they're just these big structures with grass growing on them. And so if you're not really aware of what those are or that they're there for this purpose, you're not going to perceive the risk of flooding, certainly the risk of breach. And I think that was largely the case here up until 2018. The second thing about flooding perception, flooding risk perception, is the need for us to understand how connected we all are. So those of us who live up on top of the ridge, who are not at risk from flooding because we're well above, don't always realize, even in 2018, realize the intensity of what was going on during that storm. As an example, I live up on top of the ridge, and at 4 a.m, my brother-in-law showed up at the door. We had no idea that the flooding was so incredible. People had to be removed from their homes by boats and end loaders. He was one of those people who had to be removed from his own just a few miles from us. We knew it was storming. We had no idea how badly. So there's that perception that is just born of not understanding how connected we are. And that's another piece of the awareness that we're trying to bring to the picture. Sydney?
Sure. And I can add that right now we're heading into an El Nino cycle. It's going to be hotter and drier possibly than it's been at any point in human history in the next few years. And, you know, this flooding was really 6 years ago now, but it's easy to forget. But it's also easy to forget that flooding and drought are just two sides of the same hydrologic coin. And the practices that we can put on the landscape to help us manage flooding are the same practices that help us be resilient in drought. So I think making that connection very clear that it comes down to soil health, and it comes down to our ability to store water in the ground, and it comes down to our ability to improve relations between us and the land and people who live on ridges and people who live on valleys. And that's something that can help us regardless of what conditions we're facing.
So may I add here, Sarah, the David's question is a good one. The floodplain mapping as it is today is extremely inadequate. And the reasons for that are several. Number one, the maps were developed without a good continuum of information. Many of them on only 50 years of rainfall data, when we're talking about thousands of years of climatic data that is important. Number two, there's been political influence on the final maps that get adopted at the local level, because of course the whole development industries don't want to be heavily regulated. So they try to influence the maps at that stage of their development. Number three, the standard of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, of a 100-year flood for planning purposes is far too low. There should be at least a 500-year flood. And now not only have we had bad information and there's other problems, but the floods are getting way, way worse. So the mapping itself has been extremely inadequate. That's just part of the greater problem of reform needed in the federal flood insurance program. We need better mapping. We also need to make other reforms. Some of them are just common sense things that should be a slam dunk in any civilized society today that's thinking about economics and equity and ecology. One of those is that the federal taxpayers pay for repeated flood damage. Only 3% of our flood policies, insurance policies, caused by repeated damage, but the payouts of the program total 30% for those properties. So there should be a limit on how many different times an individual can be subsidized to rebuild by the taxpayers when they just keep being subject to the same hazard over and over again. Repeated damage should be better effectively controlled and moderated in the program. So other common sense reforms are, our disclosure of flood risk should be required for the sale of a property in a floodplain. It's not. Most people who buy a flood-prone property don't know it's flood-prone. That would be another very simple common sense reform to make. And of course, better mapping would be a third easy reform, should be easy reform to the federal flood insurance program and this whole federal engagement that David has mentioned.
Thank you all for those perspectives. It seems like there are parts of awareness and education at all scales, from the local to know what's in your backyard and know how the rivers and streams like affect you and your neighbor, to how the federal flood insurance program manages crises on those rivers. We have another caller on the line. We have Jimmy. Welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi. I had a question. Question/comment. One of the kind of issues with flooding that happens a lot is pollutants like farm runoff, the primary example, can absolutely destroy some of our watersheds, especially the aquatic. Aquatic insects and of course the fish, and so I think we also need to talk about how can we not prevent floods, but how can we help farms prevent their runoff during flood events from destroying our resources.
Thank you, Jimmy. To my guest, do you have a perspective on this?
Sure, I could comment on that. You're absolutely right, Jimmy. There are enormous pollution problems that result during and after floods. And there's a whole long list of best management practices that can be used in farming. And many, if not most, farmers are doing their best to meet those standards. But still a lot more could be done. And agricultural extension agents all over the United States are promoting these kind of reforms and trying to help farmers do a better job at limiting the amount of fertilizer, let's say, that's applied to floodplains, and controlling stormwater runoff through feedlots is an enormous problem during floods, and just a whole long list of other kind of reforms that could be taken. One thing that should be considered as a part of all that is retiring the most flood-prone farmland. You know, these are really farmed floodplains. They're not flooded farmlands. The floods came first. They will always be there as long as we're intensively farming areas that are frequently flooded. We're going to have these problems. And in many cases, it would be cheaper and more effective for public agencies to simply buy easements to allow certain types of farming, but not others that cause the most destruction, or to retire the most frequently flooded farmlands altogether and be done with that problem. So that's one area that should be considered far more than it has been in the past.
Sydney, is that something that is happening or is on the table in Western Wisconsin?
Well, I think zoning is always something that we're concerned about, and also not something that we really have too much authority over as a nonprofit. But I think that a lot of the practices that make us resilient to flooding and strategies for meaningfully addressing flooding carry over into so many other parts of people's lives in the Coon Creek watershed and have so many other benefits, whether that's reducing your inputs because you're changing your cropping practices, or cultivating healthy soils that are going to hold those nutrients and hold water at the same time. And, you know, that helps with flooding, that helps with water quality, that helps protect species like brook trout and endangered freshwater mussels in our streams. And, you know, also create strong rural economies and thriving communities. And that's something we're extremely interested in. Nancy?
No, I'm glad you pointed those things out, raising awareness and educating and building community around these issues are certainly one of the huge goals of our Watershed Council.
Yeah, and Tim, in the last few minutes of the show, I want to circle back to the title of your book, Seek Higher Ground. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask what that means and how it might be achieved. And then to Nancy and Sydney, after we hear from Tim, what's your perspective on seeking higher ground?
Yeah. The title of the book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis, makes the point that I've described here, that we've done a lot of things in an effort to decrease flood damage. And many of those are worthwhile. And we're certainly pushed forward by people with the best of their intentions, but it hasn't been enough, it hasn't been effective, and we've neglected far too much the very fundamental issue, the most common sense approach, which is to get out of the way of flood damage, to not have development where it's going to be flood damaged in the future, and to help people move up and away from the flood hazard wherever they are willing to go. And a lot of people are willing to do that. Every year, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, gets far more requests for funding to help people move than they're able to meet, because so much of the federal money is spent rather in helping people stay where they are. So those are the kind of reforms that are needed. That's what I mean by in the suggestion that we seek higher ground as we approach this whole problem of floodplain management and flood damage in the future.
Before we go to Nancy and Sydney, I want to squeeze in one last caller who's given the station a call to ask you some questions. We have Sierra on the line. Can you please be brief in the last moment we have here?
Sure, thanks. I was just curious if there was any movement toward restoring natural coastlines, like in Milwaukee, just put boulders up all over Lake Michigan shoreline and messed that up. And here in the Isthmus, where there was flooding, they created a river and messed up the shoreline in the lakes. And I was wondering if there was any work being done to restore those natural coastlines. Thank you.
Thank you, Sierra. To my guests here, does anybody have a perspective on what's happening in Milwaukee, Tim?
Well, no, except that Milwaukee has had a very effective program at helping people relocate, as I mentioned. But in terms of the coastal issue, I don't know much about that in the Great Lakes. On the seacoast lines, yes, a lot has been done to try to have solutions that more effectively mimic what nature would do, like have dune construction through natural means rather than flood walls and levees, because the dunes are much more effective at mitigating the damage of hurricanes and rising sea level. I mean, at the coastlines, we have these problems magnified many times because not only do we have greater storms, but we have rising sea level. So, you know, how long are we going to support billions of dollars to help people stay when the sea level's going to rise anyway? It raises this really tough question and points out the importance of natural solutions like this caller has mentioned.
Yeah, and those natural solutions are very much on the mind, I think, of what Nancy and Sydney, that your organization is focused on. Do you want to have the last word here about higher ground or resilience in your community?
Sure, I'll jump on for just a moment. Seeking higher ground, that is absolutely something that does need to happen. Where and when that is possible, the other part of that for us is to think about and concentrate on what we are doing to create our own flooding problems, and then what we can do to mitigate against those and reduce those. So there's, you know, it seems more than one solution out there, depending upon what each situation is, because if we don't take these necessary steps for the environment on a large scale and on a wider scale, we're just repeating problems again in another way that are just creating more problems. So I'll let Sydney add if she's got anything.
Sure, yeah. I mean, seek higher ground when and where that's possible. But I think we also need to seek out each other. I think we have a lot of power when we're organized. And we're seeing that right now in the Coon Creek watershed. And, you know, our membership is free and open to anyone, no matter where you live. If you're interested in learning more about us, you can go to our website. That's CoonCreekWatershed.org, or like us on Facebook at Coon Creek Community Watershed Council. Please come and visit us if you're listening in Madison. We're just a short drive down Highway 14. May 4th, we're having a large festival in our watershed at the site of the first Watershed Conservation Demonstration Project. And we'd love to see everyone there if you're around to join.
Absolutely. We will link to that event in the web post for this show today. And Tim, Nancy, Sydney, I am so grateful for your time, for joining us on the show. It has been such an illuminating conversation about local issues, national issues, really scaling all those on the topic of floods. You can find more about Tim on his website, that's timpalmer.org, and learn more about Nancy and Sydney's work with the Coon County Watershed Council at CoonCreekWatershed.org. You've been listening to A Public Affair. Thanks to our sound engineer, my man, Andrew Thomas, our producer, Jade Iseri Ramos, all our listeners for putting up with our soundboard issues today. We are learning. We are growing. Our receptionist today is Nancy and news director, Shali Pittman. Douglas Haynes is your regular host of this program, and I'm Sarah Gabler. Up next is Madison Bookbeat. Today's host, Andrew Thomas, is going to discuss UW-Madison professor Jerome Kamal's book, Creolized Aurality. Keep it tuned here to your community-sponsored station, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted.
We come and listen and support it. At least five people killed in a suspected Israeli airstrike in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Video posted online shows a building flattened by a big explosion in the Mezzeh district of Damascus. More from Hugo Bashega.
This is a very significant escalation. Iranian and Syrian state media saying that an Israeli airstrike targeted the Iranian consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus. And now reports suggest that the senior commander of the powerful Iranian Revolutionary Guards, Mohammad Reza Sahel,